Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Nate Klarfeld with Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, my guest is Dan Bukatinski, who wrote, produced, and starred in the indie romantic comedy All Over the Guy. In 2003, he and partner Lisa Kudrow founded Is or Isn't Entertainment, which produced the cult HBO comedy The Comeback, starring Bukatinski as publicist Fiddley Stanton. The acclaimed docuseries Who Do You Think You Are is in its third season on NBC. The pair have also garnered critical and audience attention for the groundbreaking web-to-TV series Web Therapy on Showtime, in which Bukatinski also stars. Web Therapy returns for a second season this July with an illustrious guest cast, including Meryl Streep. Welcome, Dan. Hello.
Hey. Hi. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. This is fun. Your book is hilarious. And my first question is, the name of the book is Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight? Now, here's the question. With all you're doing, how did you find time to write this book?
Well, that's a good question, because it wasn't easy. It began really as part of a performance series I was doing in Los Angeles with other writers and actors and authors and comedians called Afterbirth, and we were performing these essays, like stories you wouldn't read about in a parenting magazine, those moments about your, you know, those moments when you realize your life will never be the same after becoming a parent. And I had been doing it for about 4 or 5 years. And I sort of accumulated in these performances enough pieces that were sort of chronological that it started to feel like the beginnings of something. And I think what happened between, you know, 2005 and 2009, when I sold the idea of the book, 2010, is I just sort of started putting together 8 or 9 of these performance pieces, and it started to feel like the beginnings of the book. And then, yeah, last year was a busy, busy time. I was writing. Every time I wasn't working, I was writing. So,
wow.
But I did it.
You did it, and you did a great job. I love the whole thing.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about how you came about being the father of two children.
Well, my husband and I have been together. It'll be 20 years this October. We didn't really talk that much about. I always wanted to be a dad, but it wasn't something that was foremost in my mind when I met him. And over the years, we talked about it, and Don wasn't a big fan of his own childhood, so in general, he wasn't a big fan of childhood in general, and sort of was reluctant to, you know. But he always said, like, if somebody left a baby on my doorstep, it would be the happiest day of my life. And he kept saying that, and he kept saying that. And I was in Italy. I talk about this in the book, in one of the first couple of chapters. I talk about how I was doing Under the Tuscan Sun, and somebody said to me something that just absolutely changed me about discovering the father in your spouse, and you know, and not in the daddy way that we discover the not in the ways that we discover the daddy in our spouse in other ways. No, it's discovering that the parent in you and in your spouse. And I called him with my Euro card, and I had like 6 minutes left on my card, and I was like, I want to, let's do it, you know. And it took a couple of years after that, but that was really when we started talking about it seriously.
Uh-huh.
And we decided to adopt. You do an open adoption, and over the course of 18 months of meeting birth moms and home visits and adoption classes and books, we were matched.
Oh, great. And your second child came about in a pretty unusual way.
Yeah, I think, well, you know what? I don't know if it's unusual. I mean, in a way it was unusual, in a way it wasn't. Like, we were ready for a second. We both have siblings, and as great as it felt to have just Eliza, and we really were pretty happy just to be the three of us, we kept feeling like we owed it to her in a way to have, and not that, again, she would have been fine being an only child, and I know plenty of, you know, kids who don't have siblings who are perfectly well-adjusted, but we both love our siblings so much that we sort of wanted to give that gift to Eliza, and we started to think about having another when our birth mom called and said that she was pregnant, and it just felt, in the minute she did that, it was like, oh, I have a feeling this is going to turn into the sibling, and it did.
Great.
Turned out to be a full sibling of our first adopted daughter. So we really were blessed to then have Jonah 2 years later. It came at a time that was right after my dad died. Again, these all became, and I was performing Afterbirth like every 6 months. So as I was going through these life, crazy circle of life, crazy experiences as a father and as a son losing my father, I was writing these essays and performing them. And, you know, that period from 2005 to 2008 when we were having our kids and I was losing my dad, there was so much stuff to write about and to try to find humor in despite how high stakes everything felt. And mm-hmm. a lot of that became sort of fodder for the book.
Great. You know, you talk about your dad a lot in the book. We'll go back to the kids in a minute. We'll talk about your dad for a minute. Tell us about your dad and your relationship with him as this unfolded.
My dad was an immigrant from Argentina, and so was my mom. And we lived in New York for a very, very long time until in New York until after I graduated college. And but my dad was always sort of felt a little bit like an outsider. He was a very short Argentinian man who really desperately, I think, wanted to feel assimilated as an American. And in that, to that end, there was always this subtle pressure for me to sort of be Bobby Brady, and for mm-hmm. him to be Mike Brady, and for us to throw a ball around in the backyard, even though it was absolutely not something that felt organic to him or to me. So he really tried, and he was a great listener. I hate to Monday morning quarterback it in the sense that after he passed away, my memory of him and my feelings for him, you know, in a very typical way, are so fond. And we definitely had our challenges, and I think growing up a young gay boy in a town where sports was really important, it was tough. It was tough because I think he had sort of hopes and expectations. Can you hear me?
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, hopes and expectations for me. But he was very supportive and always encouraged me when I wanted to try something new. And I really credit him a lot with sort of my ability, even as a grown-up, to be courageous enough to try things that I would normally never try. And so I loved him for that. And I think a lot of how I turned out the way I turned out, it was because of him. So.
You know, you're a family. You're a full-fledged, you know, American family, wife. You know, two kids. You know, picket fence, the whole shtick. But most of the book, or a lot of the book, goes back to defining a family. You know, you're defining yourself like in other people's eyes a lot in the book. You're looking at other couples, married, you know, husband, wife, male, female. Heterosexual couples. I don't know what to call them.
Yeah.
Sex. I guess they're different sex couples. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, and you're constantly comparing yourself. Okay, straight
yeah.
couples, whatever they are.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't say that word that much. So straight couples, you know, so you're comparing yourself to straight couples and defining a family, you're trying to get this new definition of family, but you're not really that different, are you?
No. No, I think in hindsight, I look back at the book after I had written it, and I also think about how much I just wanted to put on paper what it felt like. You know, I'm neurotic as I'm, you know, crazy half the time and paranoid and worried about whether I'm doing everything right. And I was at first nervous to be that exposed mm-hmm. in my writing. But I also found it really cathartic to just not be afraid to let people see how, you know, the things I was secure about, the things I was insecure about, and the facts that I was trying to be this family, but also questioning myself the whole time and wondering what I looked like in the eyes of other people and wondering if I was doing it right and wondering if, you know, all that sort of panic and insecurity and worry and heartfelt desire to get it right is all sort of boldly and nakedly on the page. And I don't, you know, at the time I was thinking, oh my God, this is scary stuff mm-hmm. to put all out there. But I also found that those are the exact moments of the book that I find I bond the most with other people about, the people who, straight or gay, or heterosexual or homosexual, who will find the book and then sort of relate to those moments where whether it's in the exact same way or in a different way, they too are absolutely petrified that their kids are going to wind up doing porn. And, you know, it's in those moments where we all have to sort of admit our, you know, our weakness and our vulnerability, really. Because when you're a parent, you're more than anything, you are expected to sort of be protector, and you are oddly the most vulnerable.
Exactly. You know, I'm a parent, so I know that too. How has the reaction been from your straight friends about reading the book? Have a lot of your straight friends read the book and said something back to you?
Yeah. Yeah, I have to say, like, I've been really, really happy about the reaction that the book has gotten. I guess the biggest surprise is how relatable it is. I mean, there's no surprise that other gay dads relate to it. You know, it feels to them very much like we've all experienced something very, very similar, in that way that all gay people, when they go to a party and you all have a coming out story, in the same way, as a gay dad, you can tell your story of how you became a parent or what it felt like, and you have an immediate bond with those who have been through the same experience. But I guess the biggest surprise were how many of the straight women who find my book, you know, how much it, I guess, you know, you could say that the gay guy's got the most in common with a straight woman in 5 million different ways, in not only in what we both obviously clearly prefer to sleep with, but also there's also these other factors. And certainly when you become a parent, there is this unspoken bond or similarity or universality in the experience. And I found more and more that the women who, and men too, but the women who found my book, and again, this is not exclusively, there were plenty of straight dads who found the book and enjoyed it as well and related to it, you know, dad to dad. Because again, at the end of the day, that is really the commonality of our experience. Mm-hmm. But I did find that a lot of the moms really, in a weird way, felt like I was speaking to them.
Right. I mean, I raising my son, I was divorced early, and I had a lot of input. I would always say things like, "He's never going to eat at McDonald's." I could have bought a McDonald's by the time the kid was 16. You know, how many of those things did you eat? How many of those words did you eat when you were?
Oh my God! The biggest one that Don and I laugh about all the time when we're watching our kids plow through. You know, there's a lollipop in one hand and their face is covered with chocolate icing, and we were literally going to have them stay away from refined sugar when we thought we were expecting. And it's like we absolutely have lost every battle of what we thought we were going to be. You know, we're not going to let our house be run in by plastic toys, and you cannot walk 3 inches in my house without running into stepping on something extremely painful, which is the piece of some toy, or running over it. Well, I've absolutely turned into everything that I promised myself I wouldn't.
Right. And has your son picked up a carrot and pretended it's a gun yet?
Oh, yeah. Every single thing in our house has been a weapon of some kind. Of mass destruction.
And you don't teach them that. Where does that come from?
No. Let me tell you something. I'm a firm believer. The nature nurture thing has never been more interesting to me and more clear and more pronounced than it was when we had a boy. Because there, you know, we've got a very prototypical 5-year-old boy who loves balls and trucks and sabers and turning everything into a weapon and using everything as something to either make a sound with or to destroy with. And it's hardwiring.
It is, and I knew that.
Just like I was hardwired to quiver at the sound of a ballad from, you know.
Or Barbara Streisand.
Or you name it, you know. You name the female vocalist. But there's some things that are just hardwired.
Right. One of your funniest lines, you quote Chris Rock and saying that, you know, he now said, "I, like Chris Rock, merely want to keep my kids off the pipe and the pole." I want to give you some solace in that. I raised my son most of the time, and he did end up going to an Ivy League school and has a really good job now, so we're okay, right?
Oh, that is great. That's great to hear. It really is inspiring to hear because, again, I'm unfortunately watch too many documentaries and too many reality shows, and I'm often thinking, like, wow, I bet you the parents of all these people never imagined that it was going to wind up like this. And then, of course, all I can do is imagine it's going to wind up like this.
Right. No, so don't do that.
No, I know, right?
We're fine. And both, in fact, it's really funny. My partner and I don't want to talk about myself very much, but my partner and I both met and had children from previous marriages. And we ended up both being the primary parent for the child. And both of our children did graduate Ivy League schools, which is really odd in the same
That's
complete
neighborhood. Awesome.
And both
awesome.
Are responsible, tax-paying, wonderful children who get along with each other now, which is even odder because I know it's like we're.
I love to hear that. That's great, though. You guys, I mean, that's a really good thing to be able to aspire to, and I love hearing that because it just inspires me to not worry so much.
Please don't. I mean, I'd worried every day of his life that I was ruining his life, and in a million different ways. And he would say, you know, things like your children said to you, like when Eliza said to you, she wanted a mommy. You know, that's one of the chapters in the book about, you know, wanting
right.
a mommy. And how did you answer that?
You've got one, and I stuck a boob in her.
No, I'm kidding.
I mean, I talked to her about the fact that, here's the thing. You don't want to negate the feeling. She's got the feeling that she wants a mommy from time to time, and we hear it. We always say, like, yeah, I bet you do. It would be great. Wouldn't it be great? Wouldn't that be great if you had a mommy? And wouldn't it be great for a kid who doesn't have a mommy to have a dad, you know, who doesn't have dads to have a dad? Like, a lot of times you'll want the thing that you don't have, and the kids
right.
who have it want the other thing. And
right.
there are kids who have a mommy and a daddy who wish they had two dads, and there are kids who have two dads that wish they had a mom. And so we sort of talk through the feeling of wanting what we can't have.
Right.
And also try to get her to talk about what are the things that she thinks, what are those things that, what does that mean? What does it
right.
mean to want a mommy? Like, what are those things that you feel like you're missing? But I don't think it's my job necessarily to try to talk her out of it or to try to say, well, I can do those things for you. You know, the truth is there's some loss and she'll miss certain things and there's a certain fact that, you know, I cannot pretend to be a woman. I can certainly provide for her and love her and nurture her and do all those things, but I cannot be a woman. As close as I come sometimes, I cannot be a woman. And so she's not going to have a mommy. And that's going to be something that we'll talk about, and she'll mourn it. Or, you know, and there's books written on this subject, and there's lots of philosophies about the wound of the adopted child or the wound of being adopted by the same-sex parent and
mm-hmm.
what that loss means to a child. And, again, there's different people will have different experiences, and I know as many people for whom that was a big problem growing up and going into an adolescence and others for whom it wasn't. You know, they'll have other things. No matter what, kids are going to grow up and have issues, problems, rebellion, all those things. And
sure.
her cross to bear may be that she didn't have a mom, but it might actually be something else.
Yeah, you have no idea. You know, and as
right.
I said, in your book, you have this hilarious, I mean, your book's just funny. I laugh out loud. I didn't have time. I had to read this out loud in public and stuff. So it was really funny to read it in public because everyone said, you know, I would like be, you know, in inappropriate times. I would laugh and stuff like that. And the corollary you put to this is you talk to another same-sex dad, and he said, yeah, my son says that all the time. My daughter says that all the time. She wants a unicorn. I'm not going to pull one out of my ass, you know. So
right.
it's the same thing, is that every child has a loss, you know. You know, they want the richer parent. They want the better car, the better home. But it's
yeah,
listen,
there are kids who have moms and dads or a more traditional parental paradigm, and they wish that they had the Disney paradigm of a mom and a dad. They want their mom and dad to be
right.
a king and a queen. So it's very typical for a kid to sort of be aspirational in that way anyway.
Right.
Not yet. Not yet. Soon.
Okay. And I'm talking to Jonah. And, you know, and
I'm talking to Eliza. Sorry.
Oh, Eliza. I didn't know which one came in. Jonah was on.
No, Jonah came in before and was throwing a basketball at me, and Eliza came in and said she wants to put on a show. So there you go.
Oh,
you've got hardwiring right there.
You got it. So how did this change your relationship with your partner, Don?
Oh,
or did it?
Well,
did it?
Oh, yeah, it definitely did. Like, I have a hard time remembering our lives before kids, and yet there were 12 years of it. So, of course, you know, in a very typical way for all parents, I think it made us – there became this common priority, this common – I don't want to call it a common goal, but it was certainly something that while each of us had our own careers and we have certain, you know, there's an age between us and we were together, yet we had very different paths of our professional aspirations and our different levels of success. And there was a lot of things that that when in our separate lives we would aspire to and work hard, and all of our passions were sort of divided towards our own individual goals. Mm-hmm. And this having kids sort of unified us in that fact. It gave us A, something to talk about all the time, and also gave us something to bond, like when the kids would go to sleep, there was this drawing towards each other that we took for granted, I think, before we had kids. So, and we also fight more. You know, there's this unbelievable thing we're both very opinionated and we both think that we're right all the time. And so we have this other thing that not only bonds us, but also at times polarizes us in terms of a very high stakes thing about which we both feel like we're right. So, yeah, it definitely did. It's an interesting thing because it brings out a lot of primary colors, I think. Yeah, but it gave us a lot of reality TV to watch when the kids fell asleep, and we bonded over our housewives.
Well, sorry. So, how are the lines of parenthood? You know, you talked about the give and take and the stuff like that. How are they blurred in your situation?
The lines of parenthood? Say that again.
Yeah. You know, you have role. You know, we have role models. You grew up with a mom and a dad. Don grew up with a mom and a dad. But you're doing this with two dads, and so you know, everyone's got a role. You know, one's a breadwinner, one's a homemaker. How are those blurred in your relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I write about this a lot in Does This Baby Make Me Look Straight? I feel like as much as we could have predicted what each one of us would have been drawn to do, what roles we would have been drawn to play in this game of, you know, house that we're playing now, that we're living. I don't know if I would have predicted how much I would have felt a sort of this draw towards the more traditionally maternal, I'll call them roles. You know, I love to play ball with Jonah, and I'm certainly more athletic than Don, and I have that on him, and I'll never let him forget it that he runs like a girl and I don't. But but at the same time, I love to cook for the kids and I love to be the one to bathe them and dress them. And I take on naturally. So I think that there's weird ways in which now two guys naturally fall into playing both roles of mother and father traditionally. And we both do both. So it is far more blurred than even the couples who are friends of ours, very close friends, and even our kids' godparents who are a traditional, you know, straight couple. I watch how there are very, very common, very universal ways in which the mom is, in the ways in which the dad defers to the mom in so many ways that it's more difficult in a same-sex couple where it's not so obvious. And I think those things have to be navigated and negotiated, and sometimes verbally, and sometimes it's nonverbal. How it just you fall into it.
But you're really in the first or second generation of same-sex couples adopting children so openly. So you're really you're going to be the role models for the 20-year-olds that are out there doing this now. You realize that?
Well, that's a nice thing to say, and I certainly hope so. Like I see how much has changed already when I meet young people, and I do often just. Being an actor and being a writer and a producer and having written this book and meeting people everywhere and meeting people of different ages, it's amazing how the young, how young people are coming out of the closet, you know, 10 years younger than I was when I did, and how much they are talking about wanting to find that person that they can settle down with and get married and have kids with. And those are things that are just taken for granted, which I think is amazing now, when at the time that I was coming out, they just seemed like dreams.
Sure. And as I said, I think your book and you just being there and just being as a same sex couple as your children turn into teenagers, you will be the role models for these guys getting their lives and families started. So, what did your children teach you?
That's so scary when you say we're role models, because I think of what the neurotic mess that I am, the hot mess of panic. panic and self-rage and self-loathing, and I, for that to be someone's model, no, I'm please, everybody who's listening, I am kidding. No, what have I learned from my kids?
Sure, what have you learned from
me? God, I'm learning things about myself and my own, talk about being your patience and your own inner strength being tested every single day. But there are things that I learned from them, and things, learning how to let go and learning what's really important and learning to be patient and learning what they need really as opposed to what I think they need and how much is not about me, and learning every day how to make what, you know, providing for them not something that is a reflection on myself. You know, it's so easy to fall into a sort of a narcissistic view of having children, that they will mm-hmm. turn out to be some version of you, or they are examples of how well you raise them, or examples mm-hmm. of how great you are. I mean, all those traps that literally just take away from the reality that you just have to quietly watch and listen as these other human beings emerge. And it's a lesson I have to teach myself every day. Mm-hmm. So I have been battling that, you know, that struggle to sort of let them emerge and teach me who they are more than I have to teach them who I think I want them to be, you know?
Mm-hmm. Are you sad that they're growing up, that they're not as, that you don't have to, like, constantly provide for them every emotional and physical thing?
I find it in some ways absolutely devastating. Like, when I look at them now, and I think I felt this way at every age, so I do see that when people tell me, like, you'll want to freeze them at every age, and I used to look at my kids at 2 and 4 and think, no, there's no way. I think if they get any bigger or any older than they are right now, I'm just going to die. And now one of them's almost 8, and the other one's turning 5, and I just want them to freeze because I love them at this age, and I'm too scared that they're going to get tattoos next year and iPods and cigarettes and boyfriends and have kids, like, what? Next year. So I am petrified of them getting older, but I do, but at the same time, at every turn, they're like I said before, they're emerging into these human beings, and I find it really exciting at the same time.
Right. Now, your partner is a little bit older than you are, so when Eliza starts dating, which is going to be, what, 18, 16, 14?
Whatever. He's hoping 11 so that he can be a grandfather really soon.
Okay.
But I am fighting it at every – he's like, we've got to get her, you know, sexually active. No, it's terrible. I'm kidding. No. But, no, he's a little older. So, when she's dating 16, 17, he'll be around 60 or 62, 63. And, I mean, he's eager to become a grandfather. And I want her to wait as long as possible. So we're going to have that little battle.
Right, but at that age, is he going to be able to interview the date when he comes home? You know, you've got to be that, you know, you've got to kind of be the macho guy when the date picks her up.
I know. I you know what? We haven't talked about that. I'm going to have to be there. I'm going to have to at least monitor. And
uh-huh.
Or maybe, he's actually got a lot, he's actually pretty good with that kind of thing. So maybe I'm the one who has to step out and take a deep breath.
Okay. We only have like a minute and 46 seconds left of this fast 30-minute interview. I can't believe how fast this has gone. A young writer walks up to you and says, I want to write a book. What would you say to him?
Wow. I would say to him, start writing. Whether you know, don't worry about the sale of the book. Don't worry about the commerce end of it. Don't worry about the end result. But if somebody feels like they have a point of view and they have something they want to say and a story to tell, the most important thing is to be writing all the time. Because from the writing will come, you know, will emerge the story and will emerge the point of view, will emerge. It's really just in the act of, it's a one of those arts, unlike acting, where you don't actually need someone to pay you or to hire you or to commission you to do the work. You just open up a book, take out a pen, or open up your computer and start typing. So I do encourage every young writer that no matter what you're doing, you just write every single day, because that's part of the process of figuring out what your voice is.
Great. That's good. I was going to ask you, I only have like 45 seconds left, who's your favorite writers? What are some of your best writers, favorite writers?
Some of my I look to different writers for different things. I happen to be a huge fan of, no surprise, of essayists like David uh-huh. Rakoff, who recently passed away and was a friend of mine, and I'm currently reading his The Other Half, which is his latest collection, and David Sedaris. I love humorists, nonfiction essayists like that. I've always been a huge John Updike fan. I love the first person narrative.
We're really getting close to the end of our interview.
Okay. So
I'm really sorry. I hate to cut you off.
That's okay. Mention Amazon. Mention how to get the book.
Oh, I forgot about that. That's right. Amazon. I got off the subject.
Dan Does Bukatinsky. This Baby Make Me Look Straight? It's
Bukatinsky.
Bukatinsky.
There we go. Bukatinsky. Amazon.com. Please buy the book.
And I'm on Twitter. You can follow me at Dan Bukatinsky on Twitter, and I will be posting a lot about this.
Okay, great. And follow me on Facebook. I'll be putting you a link up.
I will. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Dan. Good night.
Good night.